while everyone's kind of making their way to the seats. Like I said, we're in the home stretch here. Only two more agenda items left. Like I said, we're ahead of schedule, so we'll keep moving along here with our record keeping and e-communications panel. I know there were a lot of questions kind of related to this topic earlier in the day, so another opportunity to hear from my knowledgeable colleagues here. So I'll turn it over to the group, and we'll keep going.
Great. I guess we'll start by way of introduction. My name is Jonathan Flanagan, and I'm a manager on the futures side, and I've been with NFA for approximately 19 years now.
Hi, I'm Brad Jaeger. I'm a senior exam manager on the OTC derivatives side. I was one of the first people in our OTC group. So I've been doing Dodd-Frank related swap dealer stuff for a while. 15 years at NFA, but almost a.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Gabe Colucci. I'm a manager with NFA in the New York office. Here, a little less than these guys. I've been with NFA for 13 years now, the last seven as a manager in the CPO CTA IB space, overseeing on-site examinations of our member firms. Just like everyone else said, awesome seeing some familiar faces outside of the exam process and outside of a Teams meeting camera. So looking forward to the discussion today.
All right. Well, welcome everyone to the record keeping and communication session. Sounds like you had a lot of questions. I'm sure everyone's interested in this session. It has been a focal point of NFA's examinations for some time now, and during our review, we have definitely uncovered a lot of issues that have resulted in disciplinary action against some of our member firms. Sorry about that. And I think actually probably about half of the disciplinary actions that we've taken against member firms were in this space. So I'm sure that you're going to have a lot of questions. If you do, feel free to ask them at the end, or if you want, you can ask them, you know, throughout the session as well. So I guess we'll kick it off. So there's going to be three main objectives of this session. The first is the regulatory requirements surrounding the creation and maintenance of communication records. Secondly, we're going to discuss the importance of having a communication monitoring program in place to supervise your AP communications. And then lastly, we'll wrap it up by discussing some of the frequent findings that we're seeing in our examinations. So without further ado, we'll kick it off by discussing the regulatory requirements section. So our FCMs, IBs, and swap dealers are required to keep full, complete, and systematic records of all transactions. That includes all filled orders, unfilled orders, canceled orders, confirmations, journals, ledgers, et cetera, et cetera. And you're required to maintain these records for a period of 5 years. In addition to that, our FCMs and our IBs are, actually, all of those members are required to keep written and oral communications that lead to the execution of a trade. That would include all quotes, solicitations, bids, offers, instructions, pricing. Really, everything that goes into the trade needs to be captured. And for our FCMs and IBs, that's required to be maintained for a period of 5 years, whereas our swap dealers, you have to maintain that for 5 years after the life cycle of the trade. On the other hand, for oral trades, for oral communications, those have to be maintained for a period of 1 year. There is a small carve-out for some of our smaller introducing brokers. So if you fall into that category, those are the firms that generate less than $5 million in revenue over the preceding 3 years, then you do not need to maintain those oral records. So there's no tape recording requirement for that. Now I'm going to pass it over to Brad, where he can continue the regulatory requirements section.
Sure. And one of the first questions we get on every exam where we talk about communication surveillance is this is not a requirement in a CFTC regulation or NFA rule. That is technically true. The word communication surveillance does not appear in the rule. However, it is a requirement, and it comes from the general supervision requirements from 2-9, and for swap dealers, the requirement in 23602 that covers supervision. And for swap dealers as well, more specifically in Part 23, the general requirements in 402, Part A, swap dealers have to have reasonably designed policies and procedures to ensure compliance with external business conduct requirements, which include the anti-fraud rules and the fair dealing rules. So we view that as communication surveillance is a necessary tool to ensure compliance with those two main components. So if you search for communication surveillance, you're not going to find it as a rule, but it is there. And that's why we talk about it as a necessary element for external business conduct rules. So we're going to shift gears a little bit now that the what the regulations say. What are some of the elements of an effective communication surveillance program? These are not enumerated in an NFA rule or a CFTC regulation, so we're going to talk about some good practices, some standard practices, things that seem to work fairly well, and some better and best practices. But if you have specific questions, you know, definitely throw up a hand and you can interject as we go through these. The first one that's been mentioned numerous times today, reasonably designed policies and procedures. They need to be clear and need to make sure that you're following them. So if you say in your policies and procedures you're going to carry out a weekly process, like that's the first thing an NFA exam team is going to do, demonstrate that you're actually doing this on a weekly basis. Just shifting gears a little bit to approved methods of communication, this is obviously one of the most essential things is what's approved, what's being recorded, and to make sure that all personnel are aware of those approved methods of communication, so again, so that records can be created and so that those records can be monitored, through the communication surveillance program. An element of that is devices. There's always considerations whether you have firm-issued devices, cell phones, or whether you can have a BYOD or bring your own device set up for APUs and for people talking on the phone that need to be recorded. BYOD programs, just an additional layer of risk that you need to be aware of just to make sure that proper records are being maintained, created and maintained so that they can be surveilled. Just kind of going to the next one. Personnel, who's responsible for that first level of review for alerts that come up? So who are the individuals that actually carry this out day to day, and where do alerts that might be problematic, who do they get escalated to, and to make sure that those personnel are properly trained and that they can handle the reviews of communications that come up, and to make sure that there's proper escalation. So all that should be laid out in the policies and procedures, and again, to make sure that, you know, those personnel carry out the function day to day. And this was mentioned, I think, in the first panel, creating an audit trail of those reviews, making sure that if you're carrying out a review process, make sure you can recreate it for NFA. You can demonstrate what was reviewed, the frequency it was reviewed, and the substance of the review as well. We do ask on exams for swap dealers, but other members as well, to kind of recreate their communication reviews. So if we say you reviewed 10 alerts on this day, we may sample those and say, you know, provide us all the records that you reviewed in addition to your conclusion and your rationale for the conclusion, whether there was no need to escalate or whether there was an escalation. And since we talked about record retention period, so the reviews of the communication records are generally a 5-year requirement to keep those records, because that's generally considered a business record. So I think that was going to be a potential question that we get asked that a lot on exams. Okay, a couple other elements just wanted to get into is ongoing training. One, to make sure that associated persons and people that are potential associated persons are aware of what they can say and on what channels they can say it on. And again, with the goal to make sure that records are being created and to make sure that they can be reviewed. And the training also extends to analysts and compliance personnel to where escalated alerts are disposed of to make sure that, you know, the people actually carrying out the surveillance function can adequately spot potentially problematic or manipulative behavior or conversations or things that are just, you know, don't fit within that fair dealing standard. Sorry, got a little trigger happy there. The next one we see a lot of are codes of conduct, just laying out the standards for professional behavior within your organization. And usually along with that code of conduct comes an attestation process on an individual basis that's usually done upon hire or when a person is designated as an associated person and then annually thereafter so that people take ownership in their own compliance, you know, with the standards set forth by the firms. Another big component of any communication surveillance program is to reevaluate the program on a periodic basis. It could be a QA type of process, but you really want to, from time to time, take a step back, look at the big picture of the program, making sure that it's still adequate. One thing to review are the types of alerts. Are you getting a lot of false positives? How can you fine-tune any automated surveillance tools? And how can you minimize those false positives so you can spend your time in the most effective way? Another thing to be considered of is the personnel. Are the right personnel being surveilled? It may work today, but as employment classifications may change, making sure that the program is up to date on who is actually being surveilled and to make sure that communication records are being created. One thing from a swap dealer side we get a lot of questions on are relationship managers or marketing personnel or personnel that may not technically trade swaps, and just making sure of that line, whether you're introducing a client to a swap dealer AP to process a trade, is to make sure that those communications are tightly monitored, controlled, and that those relationship managers don't cross the line into solicitation to be considered in AP. One thing that could be done of relationship managers is to ingest them into the communication monitoring program just to make sure that those communications kind of fall outside the definition of associated person. You know, we see it at regional banks a lot where banking activity is the primary business, and a swap may be entered into with a client to hedge a particular exposure. But just to make sure that those relationship managers or non-associated persons know what that dividing line is. If you're just passing off somebody to a swap AP saying, hey, we also trade swaps, you should talk to so-and-so who is a swap dealer associated person, that's probably okay. But if you're discussing, if a relationship manager is discussing particular terms of a swap, pricing of a swap, the benefits of a swap, that's when they kind of cross over that moving target of whether they're an associated person or not. So those are things to kind of do periodically as you're reviewing communication surveillance programs to make sure the right personnel are being recorded. The next concept I wanted to introduce quickly was unapproved communication channels. I'm sure everyone's seen CFTC and SEC actions recently about APs and supervisors of APs communicating off of approved channels and that regulatory records are not being created, they're not being surveilled. So I don't think we need to say too much about it, but any good program, again, keep in mind what channels people are using. If you do business in a certain jurisdiction, foreign jurisdiction, and what's commonly used in that region to communicate and to make sure that that's considered when you're setting up a communication surveillance program. And lastly, we expect policies and procedures to have a fairly clear disciplinary framework laid out. One, it shows that the swap dealer or other members, you know, you take violations of any type of misconduct seriously, or there's communications that are not within the fair dealing standards, one, that they're taken seriously, and that there's a process laid out for any potential misconduct by APs, that they're escalated to the right personnel and that the right decisions are being made. When we do review these disciplinary frameworks, we don't expect to see like a one-for-one, if this happens, this is the outcome. If this happens, this is termination. It's more of a process, like who makes the decision and what's kind of the range of disciplinary actions that could result, anywhere from retraining, verbal warnings, written warnings, like up to and including termination. But it doesn't have to be laid out as a one-for-one scenario, but just to make sure that there is a process and the right people are involved in that process.
Okay. I know that was a lot of information, so I'll just pause. Any questions at this point? Wow. Okay.
At least four so far.
Maybe I should have reserved those for the end.
Hi. I just wanted to confirm something you said at the very beginning, or toward the beginning of the session. Did you say that unlike the other registrant categories that have to keep the pre-trade communications for 5 years, the swap dealers have to keep it for the life cycle of the swap plus 5 years?
Correct. Yeah, the swap dealer requirements are an extended record-keeping time frame. Most transaction-specific records, including pre-trade records, are required to be kept for the life of the trade plus 5 years. So if it's a 20-year interest rate swap, it's really a 25-year record-keeping requirement, with the exception of voice records. That's still a one-year requirement.
So dealing with the most recent off-channel communication sweep, there was a firm that had told me that was caught up in that sweep that one of the things that they did to remediate the issues that led to the ultimate fine was that, A, they made their policy very clear to their employees, and, B, they encouraged self-reporting to the point that they took into account if something was self-reported, what was the intent of the person, and they almost got, like, I'm going to call it internal cooperation credit. And they found that as a result of that, 80% of the issues that ended up getting escalated and, I guess, the firm found out about were actually all self-reported. And generally they took the approach that if it was self-reported, the individual would not be subject to discipline. I'm just wondering, because we've had a lot of internal debate about that approach in my firm, have you seen other firms take that kind of approach just because there's a hypersensitivity right now around off-channel communications? And from the industry's perspective, I think we would expect that the regulators would want us to be reacting to issues irrespective of how they're communicating internally. But have you seen other firms take that approach where if something is reported in-house, the individual may not necessarily be disciplined versus had the firm discovered it themselves?
Yeah, I mean, any type of proactive approach to get ahead of this, rather than waiting for an inquiry from the CFTC or from the NSA, is a positive step in the right direction. We may ask for those types of internal control reports, like, what did you identify as you're reviewing your program? And if you show us, hey, we identified 10 potential instances of off-channel communication, we'll ask about them. We'll still investigate it to see the extent of it. We want to understand the nature of it, how it started, how you identified it. And even if it was a true violation, it still gives us comfort that your system and process is working. So all those communications to us is helpful. We're still going to ask about it if it's a potential violation, but you get some credit for bringing it to our attention and kind of helping us and also showing that your program is working and that you're catching it before there is an investigation. So I would encourage any kind of proactivity in that area for sure.
I wonder if you can elaborate on one of your comments. I think you say that you see potentially higher risk in bringing your own device versus corporate device program. And if that is the case, and you can provide additional information about the risk that you observed, have you observed best practices on how firms address those additional risks?
It's really up to the nature of the device and how it's used. If text messaging is permitted, how are you creating those records? If calling on a personal device is permitted, are there apps in place to make sure that it's still being recorded? But any type of bring-your-own-device usually involves the AP pushing a button to start the recording on a conversation, or if it's through firm software. But as long as that process is controlled and records are being created, and you're aware of those risks and you've taken steps to mitigate them, like, that's really how our conversations would go as an exam team. We want to see what risks did you identify, how are you mitigating them, and then we would determine if it's a reasonable approach or not, is kind of the big picture of how the conversations would go.
With regards to surveillance of voice records, is there any guideline or guidance on the percentage of voice records? It's a very time-consuming process. It takes up a lot of time of limited surveillance resources who are better off looking at IM chats and emails because that's an easier search. But is there any guidance? I know this is subjective. It's the surveillance program that we believe is right for our firm, but we have found perhaps that our subjective view is different from the NFA's subjective view. So is there any guidance on the number of percentage of voice we should be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I can start there. We're going to jump into kind of an in-depth discussion of reviews and what should be taking place, but, you know, as a general statement, I would say no. You know, there's no number that we're going to give you or that you're going to give us to say that we're totally comfortable, right? You know, I think it's one piece of the supervisory framework. So we look at all of your activities holistically and say, okay, if you're doing 5 to 10% of an e-com review, coupling that with a 5 to 10% trade reconstruction. So we look at that together and say, okay, based on the activities of the firm, that's reasonable. But again, it's very case by case. We just don't want to put a blanket number out there because it might fit for you, but it might not fit for somebody over here. So we'd be hesitant to, you know, really commit to anything today.
If there's a protocol where someone in the business can turn off recording because it's an internal call, is there anything in particular you're going to be looking at to confirm that it wasn't shut off when it shouldn't have been? Like, how would you ask that question in an exam?
Yeah, I mean, I would be very wary of any software being turned off. You know, there is still responsibility to maintain internal communications with, you know, between brokers, between APs, between sales reps. So just because it's an internal conversation doesn't mean that that won't lead to the execution of a commodity interest. Therefore, that record should have been created and maintained in accordance with 135. So, yeah, I would be very, very hesitant to instruct any of your employees to disable any software that you put in place to be in compliance. So I just think that's a very slippery slope you'll be going down.
Yeah, and along with that, it goes to what are the policies and procedures? Is that part of the code of conduct? Are the employees aware of when they can turn off recording? And are there controls around it? Like, how do you demonstrate to us that it's being done properly? And combined with that, certain lexicon terms and phrases of written communications should search for those types of things, like, hey, turn off recording, call me on my mobile, call me on my cell, text me. Like, those types of things in written communication should also be looked at as part of, again, the holistic process and whether it's reasonable or not.
Yeah. In addition to that, I mean, some of the questions we could potentially ask is, you know, prove to us that this wasn't a part of a conversation that led to the execution of trade. If that recording doesn't exist, it's going to be nearly impossible for you to prove it. So that is one of the questions that we could potentially ask during an examination. So like Gabe said, it's a slippery slope. I would strongly recommend against that.
Okay. Any more discussion? One more, sorry.
I just had a quick question kind of as a to tag on to that regarding the amount of voice reviews. It was always kind of our interpretation at our firm that if you were to transcribe the voice or the oral communications into a text or into like text transcript, that you would need to retain it for the life of the swap plus 5 years because we're a swap dealer. But if we were permitted to do that and then delete it after a year, you know, we could apply lexicons and automated alerts and other such things that would make it, you know, much more efficient potentially. Is there any kind of reconsideration in light of all the reviews and everything that are going on?
Just a couple comments there. The first, if you do transcribe voice and then it's carried out as written surveillance, e-com surveillance once it's transcribed, that's a good process. What some of the things we'll ask about, How do you ensure that the records are accurate? Are they being transcribed accurately? Do you have quality control to make sure that the actual words said get transcribed? Obviously, it won't be 100%, but how do you get comfortable with it? Are different languages being used and to making sure they're being transcribed and or translated to create those e-communication records at that point? I believe those would be electronic records at that point once they're created. So it would be life of the trade plus the 5 years would be the second part of that. And again, that comes from the CFTC regulations. So even if we had control over it, I don't know if we could or would change it, but that's from their regulations.
Okay, for time purposes, I think we'll move on. So maybe the next couple slides will obviously answer any questions that you had. So, you know, similar to many other supervisory frameworks that member firms are required to implement, you know, this communication monitoring program is not one size fits all. So, you know, it should really be tailored to your activities, to your, you know, your personnel in place. So with that being said, you know, I'm going to cover a number of minimum requirements that we would expect to see and also some best practices that, you know, you guys can implement in various degrees based on the resources available to you, you know, from a cost perspective. So that's what, you know, the first thing we wanted to talk about and the first requirement is to conduct comprehensive reviews of employee communications. So whether you're building out this communication monitoring program from scratch, you know, maybe you're reevaluating an existing program, the starting point should always be a very thorough risk assessment of your firm's business model. So at a minimum, this will at least indicate you or steer you in the right direction of how often these reviews should be occurring. You know, obviously the most common ones we see in the industry are monthly. You know, so for some of the smaller shops with, you know, very vanilla operations, maybe on a quarterly basis. But on the other end of that spectrum, you know, after you do this thorough risk assessment, you might see certain high-level risk areas where you say, okay, we might need to be doing something daily, something weekly. So I think that's always your starting point. Conduct that risk assessment and then go from there. So when implementing the program, you know, it's important to keep in mind that these reviews are just not completeness testing, right? So you're not just ensuring that the record exists. You know, these reviews should be reasonably designed to identify non-compliance with these communications. So, you know, a couple examples from a sales and solicitation perspective, you know, these reviews should be able to uncover, you know, high-pressure sales activities. You know, if you identify an AP that has a huge influx in new customers, you know, maybe do a targeted review. Just make sure that, you know, he wasn't communicating anything misleading, you know, not using misleading promotion material. From a trade activity review, you want to make sure that, you know, APs and brokers are not disclosing non-public information. So that's what these reviews should allow you to accomplish from a regulatory perspective. It's just not making sure that the record exists. So finally, you know, it's very important that these reviews encompass all activities and employees of the firm. It's very important that things don't slip through the cracks and go unmonitored. So that risk assessment should really identify what means of communication that you have allowed employees to use, and then make sure that those platforms are integrated into any record retention systems and then monitored on an ongoing basis. So the last bullet here that we just wanted to remind everyone of is that the firm should have a systematic record process in place. Again, the initial risk assessment should make sure that you identified all platforms, methods of communication that are allowed and in use, and then making sure that those are ingested into your record retention systems. The more automated this can be, the better. You know, obviously, when there's a manual aspect of record retention, everyone knows things could go wrong. Not by any deceptive behavior, but just by, you know, thousands and thousands of calls are generated in a week, you know, just getting them manually moved over to some sort of cloud service or some sort of internal file sharing system, things can always go wrong. So the more you can automate it, the better. Okay. So now that the frequency and the scopes of review have been established, I kind of just want to talk about some of the ways that you can go and implement these reviews on a day-to-day basis. You know, the first one we have is to use automated means of reviews. So it's likely that most of the firms that are members of us, you know, will have to go out and purchase, you know, third-party monitoring programs. You know, obviously, if you have in-house technology resources available to you that can build something in a proprietary nature, great. But again, you know, we do see a lot of our member firms needing off-the-shelf software to use. So although, you know, we're not going to recommend any vendors, I'm sure that was said numerous times throughout the day, you can always look at Interp 9079 that discusses, you know, third-party vendors, the due diligence, just making sure that you're meeting all of those reviews and making sure that their software is applicable and reasonable based on your operations. And then also just a reminder, you know, obviously any alerts, reviews, escalations that the system triggers, make sure you have a process in place to clear those. You know, making sure that the people clearing those alerts are knowledgeable, they understand the business, they are able to talk to the traders, they're able to talk to the brokers, the sales reps, to gain an understanding of what occurred in these communications, and basically not just be told to go away, right? You really need people that are able to clear these in an effective and efficient manner. So another thing that I think we can really recommend as a best practice is the use of lexicons. I think, you know, Brad mentioned that, and I'm sure other panels today too. Lexicon keyword searches are invaluable sometimes, especially with larger firms that have millions of lines of communication. You know, we do understand it's not reasonable that, you know, you're going to have a person sitting there reviewing those. It's just not efficient, and it's really not going to be effective. So the keyword searches are great. I think the great thing about them is that they can be targeted. So you can really, you know, you can start at a very high level with, you know, 3,000 words and then drill down, you know, maybe a more targeted list looking for disclosure of non-public information. So it's really, you can kind of manipulate the keyword search list to where you've identified the most risk and implement that on a case-by-case basis. I'm just going to skip over this last bullet and we'll come back to that. So another best practice, especially for firms that are conducting execution services or brokerage activity for their customers, is performing trade reconstructions. So this is where firms will be, you know, doing completeness testing of their records. From the start of the trade process all the way to the end. So you want to make sure when that initial indication of interest comes into the AP, you know, whether that be via IM chat, email, phone, you know, that initial record is created and maintained. You know, search for counterparty, we want to make sure that communication is maintained. You know, confirmation of the trade, we want to make sure those records are maintained. So really the entire life cycle of the order needs to be have a record to be able to substantiate all the details in the negotiation process. This will also allow you guys to be able to identify non-compliance, you know, with APs handling this trade. You know, they might be, you know, not following the customer's directions. You know, they might be going rogue and showing bids and offers that weren't provided to them and are not, you know, tradable. So these are things that if you perform these trade reconstructions coupled with the communication monitoring, you'll be able to identify. And just a, you know, a last kind of reminder here is that, you know, making sure that the trade reconstructions are a representative sample of the activity that's actually going on at the firm. You know, if you have multiple trading desks across multiple offices across the globe, you want to make sure that your sample of testing includes trades from each of those trading desks. If you have different products that you guys focus on, you know, whether, you know, it be energy, you know, gold, metals, swaps, you want to make sure you're touching all of those. You want to make sure that you're getting trades reconstructed from all of those desks. And you also want to make sure that it's a representative sample number-wise. I know I said before I'm not going to commit to a specific number, but you guys need to get to a comfort level that you're doing enough trade reconstructions to be able to say, okay, you know, if we had some communication platform that's not being recorded, we would have found it by now. So, you know, really making sure that the number you're doing is in line with what's going on at the firm. And just quickly going back, so now you perform these reviews, now what, right? So I think it's very important that, not just important, you are required to accurately document these reviews. This includes at a minimum, you know, who performed the review, what communications were reviewed, what trades were reconstructed, and if there were any issues that were identified, how were they escalated, what investigation took place to be able to say, you know, what occurred was reasonable and not in violation of any rules and regulations. And just a reminder, I know this has come up in a number of our recent exams, you know, just signing a document to say that, you know, Q3 of 2023 trades were reviewed, that's not enough. You know, we need substantive evidence to show that you guys are able to show to us as regulators what was performed. Again, you know, this doesn't, you know, need to be for every trade, or it doesn't need to be every communication, but you have to be able to recreate it for us, and just an attestation or a simple checklist, that's not sufficient. So that pretty much covers, you know, the best practices that we can recommend today, and, you know, obviously the minimum standards that are required. So I'll pass it back to John. Sorry.
Great. Well, we're going to wrap up the session by discussing some of the findings that we routinely see in our examinations. And on the slides, there's some broad topics and broad findings that we commonly come across. The best place to start with, I think, is the firm's procedures themselves, or lack thereof. The procedures should be descriptive enough where it should specify the approved methods of communication. So if an AP is hired, he should be able to read that procedures and be able to know which channels he is able to communicate. And if it's not descriptive enough, I mean, that's not sufficient. In addition, we also come across the surveillance and the supervision of those communications not being adequate. At a bare minimum, I would expect it to include who's required to review that information, the frequency of the review, what it should entail, and then how that review would be documented. If you are performing an activity for a regulated function, it has to be in writing. So it really has to be in writing. There's really no exceptions to that. But a lot of times we'll go to the firms and they'll have something in writing in their procedure, and then when we go to test it, it's not being done, or vice versa. And either way, it's incorrect, and it does commonly come up in our examinations. The next large area that we come across is the failure to maintain records. We established the time frames earlier on, but sometimes they're not being retained in accordance with the rules and regulations. Some firms will hire or go outside to utilize a third-party vendor. Just to keep in mind, some of those vendors have different tiers of service. Just make sure the tier of service that you select is appropriate for your operations and your regulatory operations as well. Sometimes we'll see that they don't that it doesn't align. The next item that we see is the failure to maintain communication records. So while it's important for an AP upon hire to know the communication methods, it's equally important, or more important, for our members to know what communications channels their brokers are actually using. So like Gabe alluded to earlier, trade reconstructions. That's what we do on our exams. That's what I suggest to our member firms. It's really, like Gabe said, a completeness testing. So if that broker is normally talks at a customer on ICE Chat, but their customer is away and doesn't have ICE Mobile on their phone, they may call up on their cell phone or send them a text message, you know, and you might not capture that. But a trade recon would capture that missed communication. And just by simply doing a screenshot or something similar to that, relying on the AP to do that, is not sufficient. And someone could easily delete a message or anything like that where that communication now would be lost. Even doing the trade reconstruction, you may not even uncover it. So definitely as of recent, we've been, in our examination reports, we've been including language saying that that wasn't sufficient, that it's a violation for not having that retention of communication automated and relying on screenshots. The next larger area is inadequate communication surveillance. As we said earlier, it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. Every firm's operations are going to, you know, vary immensely. If, for example, if you have 20 brokers, you know, maybe doing 1,000 trades a month, and you're only doing 3-4 trade reconstructions, it's definitely not going to be adequate. Now, only doing trade reconstructions is also not going to be adequate, because then you're only reviewing the trades that lead to the execution of a trade. There's another piece of the puzzle that is not being reviewed. So you should not only be reviewing the trades that lead to the execution of a trade, you should also be reviewing the other communications as well. In addition to that, a lot of the brokers, they may speak to their customers in foreign languages. So if you are using that lexicon list, we would expect that there would be an English version as well as the foreign language version. The supervisory personnel would be fluent and be able to read that foreign language to properly supervise them. And if that's not in place, then that would also be a deficient item. And then the last item that I quickly wanted to touch upon, and I think the last panel touched upon it a little bit, was the inadequate response to an outage in the recording system. We realize that it can happen, and there's a variety of factors that would come into play whether or not that would be deemed to be a deficient item. Some of the factors that we would think of is how long did it occur? Did the firm investigate the root cause of the outage? Was the firm able to identify what records went missing? Was the firm able to recover those records? And then if so, were they re-ingested into the firm's systems so then they could be properly maintained and then ultimately properly supervised? And those are the main findings that we see in our examination. I think that really concludes the session. Now, if anyone has any additional questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Just quickly, regarding communications in foreign languages, you said the supervisor needs to be conversant in that language. So would it not be permissible for, another person in the control function who does know that language to provide a translation? Because sometimes, you will have, say, an Asian head of sales who will speak Mandarin but not Cantonese or vice versa. So just wondering about that.
I think that would be okay. I mean, to me, that would be an adequate control that you have over place over it. So, supervise it, but ultimately it's translated and then properly supervised.
Yeah, and we do see it a lot in swap dealers as they are multinational. So the first thing we ask is, do you know what languages are being used, yes or no? And then if you're not surveilling in those languages, how are you comfortable, monitoring those languages that the analysts aren't reviewing? What we've seen in terms of common findings, like we'll see a log of analyst reviews, and the review will just say it was in Spanish, pass on review, the person didn't speak Spanish. Like, that's an insufficient response to a voice, like a review of something in a language that the analyst doesn't know. There needs to be a process either to translate it or get it to someone that can properly review it and close it.
On the text message example you just gave, where potentially a client, a trader, is remote and texts a broker, That broker then saves that text message, sends it to compliance. It's now in the record. It's now saved. Are you saying that isn't adequate in extreme circumstances where we're trying to fulfill that client's requirement and get the trade done for that client?
I think if you can show and demonstrate that it's a true one-off scenario, I think that would be okay. However, if you do a larger review and you're coming across this more and more often where maybe it's not a one-off and it's just a routine part of their business, well, then maybe that is not okay. I've had firms that tell me that it's really an anomaly for this to occur, and then we'll do 3 or 4 trade reconstructions, and then in half of them, we find text messages. I mean, that's not going to be, you know. So I think it would really depend. If it really is the one-off scenario, I think ultimately it would be okay. But I think a larger review should probably occur just to make sure that it's truly one-off.
Understood. Just to be clear, though, if they're capturing the communication, you're saying because it's not automatically captured, it doesn't satisfy the NFA.
Yeah, because there could be a piece of that conversation that's easily deleted. And if they take a screenshot of that text message, there's a chance that you may never know that something was deleted. So it's a nice backup for that anomaly, for that situation, but we do require the automated.
And that's explicitly articulated in the rules somewhere.
Well, it's your responsibility to supervise your APs. And if an AP, you are losing the control if it's not automated. So there's no way you can properly supervise those brokers if they have the capability to delete a message and then record it.
Okay, thank you.
But if they are independently creating the record and we can't show that there's a missing record, yeah, from a purely record-keeping standpoint, it's technically okay. However, it goes to the bigger picture supervision. Is there a proper control to make sure that this doesn't happen? Are traders aware not to text message anything substantive? If there is a text message, do they steer it back onto a recorded channel to process the whole trade and to create that automated record? So from a supervision standpoint, yeah, we would look for a better automated control. But from a purely record-keeping standpoint, if the record is there, technically it's there, but it goes to that bigger control, and is the whole process reasonable or not?
You mentioned a well-designed monitoring program doesn't rely on trade reconstructions alone. Does that go the other direction, that it's a well-designed monitoring program should not rely on communication surveillance, that trade reconstructions should be a component of that?
Yeah, I think they need to be in place tandemly to really provide a comprehensive framework, because I think they're each independently accomplishing two different things. So like kind of John referenced before, you know, trade reconstructions is more completeness testing, and you're really only looking at communications that led to an execution. So you would assume that everyone was in agreement. You know, by not looking at communication records outside of those trade reconstructions, you're not going to be able to find if an AP or a broker mishandled a negotiation and the customer said, "You blew this one, I'm out." So I think you're missing a big part of what's going on if you're only doing one or the other.
All right, I think that wraps up our session. I think we're no longer ahead of schedule, but
that's your fault, not ours.
But no, thanks so much for the questions and for bearing with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That brings us to the last session of the day, cybersecurity.